Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto on July 21st. And before I go any further, let me wish my number two son a very, very happy 21st birthday. He celebrates 21 today. And in fact, I put a picture of him in the blog. He's looking quite good over at Texas A&M as he's doing some summer projects over there. Adriana, how are you?
Fine. How are you, Silvio?
Okay. For a minute there, I thought I had lost you. So
now I'm here.
Great. Well, good to hear from you. We'll be talking today with our friend Bill Katz, and we're going to be talking about the Apollo 11 landing, which a historic day for many of us. And we're also going to be getting some of his thoughts on Walter Cronkite, one of the legendary media figures of the 20th century. And then, Adriana, you and I are going to have a little roundtable like we always do, and today joining us is a fellow named Alberto de la Cruz, who is a blogger out of Miami who's been doing some great work with the Babalu blog, probably the most successful of all of the Hispanic blogs in the country. And he's been doing some postings on Honduras, and that's going to be very interesting. He's discovered a connection between, in fact, I think our friend Bill wrote about this as well, a connection between Chavez and Zelaya, the president or the ex-president of Honduras. So we'll be talking a little bit about that. So let's kind of set the table, though, as we talk about Apollo 11. Let's set the table, Adriana, and let's play a little tune here about the moon. There's a lot of songs about the moon, and this is one of the most popular ones.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. In other words, darling, all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true.
Fly Me to the Moon, and that particular interpretation is by a fellow named Danny Fong, F-O-N-G, and I'm not familiar with his CDs or anything like that, but I found this this song here in the inventory of Blog Talk Radio, and as long as we're talking about the moon, Bill Katz, why not play a song about the moon? How did you
That's
like
right.
that one?
That was a pretty good one. You know, as you said, the moon has been the subject of so many songs, just in older generations, Blue Moon, when the moon came over the mountain, Harvest Moon, Shine on Harvest Moon, which is one of the great romantic favorites of the early part of the 20th century, and one of the most written about subjects in the history of song.
That's right, and there was one that Elvis recorded too. I remember hearing it the other day, Blue Moon of Kentucky, right?
I think there was a song, yes. I'm not familiar
yeah.
with it. But
yeah.
I think
and then,
I
of course, Blue Moon was a huge hit, wasn't it?
Blue Moon
times.
Was Rodgers and Hart, and yes, that was one of the great Rodgers and Hart songs.
And you know, it's interesting because the moon for years, as you were saying, let's say hello to Adriana. Adriana, do you like songs about the moon?
Well, actually, both of them I like. The one that you just played, it makes me think about my parents because I think, I don't know which generation usually used to hear that song, but it's a nice song. And the one of Blue Moon, I also remember listening to it. So, yeah, they are beautiful songs, both of them.
And, Adriana, you may remember a song in Spanish that we kind of grew up listening to. It's actually a little older than both of us, but there's a song in Spanish called Te Quiero Dijiste, which in when it was done in English, it was Magic is the Moonlight, which was also a very popular tune back, I guess it would have been in the 50s or so. Do you remember that song, Bill, Magic is the Moonlight?
No, I actually don't.
Julia Brewer, I think, was the lady who sang it. But anyway, I was doing a little research on moon songs, guys. That's why I'm trying to impress all of you with my knowledge of moon songs. But
well, back in the 50s, one of the big favorites was Moonlight Bay. Did you say Julia Brewer?
Well, I think I may have the name wrong.
There was a famous singer in the 50s named Teresa Brewer.
Maybe I have it.
Yeah.
Maybe I have it wrong. But this is a song that was originally recorded in Spanish, called Te Quiero Dijiste. And then when they, you know, sometimes when they do the translation, they cannot do a literal translation.
Right.
So they'll come up with some version of it and Magic is the Moonlight is the way they did it. But the reason we're talking to Bill Katz today is, of course, because of the landing on the moon, and we also want to get your thoughts on the passing of Walter Cronkite. But, Bill, before we get to that, though, I have to ask you a question. You wrote a lot about President Obama, and it seems, you know a lot more about this than I do, but it seems like he's having some real polling data problems. And I don't know how much of that is consistent across the board in all the polls, or whether it's just Rasmussen, who seems to be putting him in very negative numbers. But I have two theories. One is that I think the country is getting tired of the generalities, and the other theory is that I think the stimulus really did him a lot of harm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
So what I was going to say is that the stimulus, I think it's sort of like the guy who comes to you and says, give me $100 and I'm going to go to the horse race, okay? And then he bets on the wrong horse, and then he comes back later and says, hey, give me another $100. And you go, wait a minute, you got a credibility problem here. And so I think there's a credibility problem with the stimulus. That's, I think, a lot of what is happening in these polls. I mean, I kind of like to get your thoughts on it.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And, presidents always decline somewhat from their original numbers because there's so much goodwill when a new president takes office. And there was a particular amount of goodwill when this president took office for historic reasons. He was the first black president. He's a very personable guy, very bright man. But I think the stimulus package passed on faith. People said, well, all right, we're in trouble. We have to pass it. I think they see months have gone by. It isn't only that it's not working. It's that pick up little bits of information from the news that they may not be able to articulate, but it's back in the back of their heads. And they see one story after another about how some of this money is being used, that it's not being used to create new jobs. It's being used for to pay off old political debts by Democratic members of Congress. We learned today, for example, that many of the jobs that are being created are actually being created in foreign companies overseas. And that isn't going to go down too well. And then after the stimulus package, remember, came the cap and trade legislation, and it was, and people weren't even allowed to read it. I mean, it just whizzed through. At least it whizzed through the House. It is not going anywhere in the Senate. But people began to realize this may cost me my job. And what's it based on? Is it really based on the science of global warming, or is it based on somebody's theory, or on Al Gore's political positions? And people are starting to question, even with the press being so much on Obama's side, people are starting to question because they feel their lives are being impacted. And certainly the greatest blow to the president in terms of his popularity has been this health care reform legislation. Is there anything more personal than health care? And yet you ask most Americans and they'll say, I don't even know what's in it. Nobody's telling us what's in it. The president himself admitted in an interview yesterday he didn't know one of the major provisions of the health care bill. And people are now saying, slow down. This doesn't have to be passed in 2 weeks. Let us look at it. Let's examine it. Let's debate it. And I think his handling of these things has hurt him substantially. But I also want to make a very important point, and that is that if you actually look carefully at his polling numbers, they began to decline at the time of the Iranian crisis, the Iranian mini-revolution, when it was perfectly evident that he got behind the news. And it took him about 4 days to finally say something positive about the freedom fighters in Iran. And I think Americans just didn't like that. They really didn't like that. And there was an immediate decline in his polls, and those numbers have been declining ever since.
Very interesting. Yeah, you wrote something about this on Saturday. You said on the path to immortality, I hope I'm quoting you correctly, but
yeah,
on the path to immortality, he ran into reality, and that's exactly what's going on. But let's talk about these two topics. Let's go with Walter Cronkite first, and then we'll deal with the Apollo 11. Your thoughts on the life and times of Walter Cronkite?
Well, it's a mixed reaction. I remember Walter Cronkite from the time I was 11 or 12 years old, because he was the first anchor to anchor television, at least on a network basis, a national convention. So I remember Walter Cronkite anchoring the 1952 Republican convention, which was noted, by the way. The most famous incident to come out of the television coverage was actually not his anchoring, but the fact that one of the commercials went bad when the model who was selling a Westinghouse refrigerator couldn't get the door open, and it became one of the most famous commercial moments in television history. But Cronkite was known as, you know, as a very good anchorman, as a solid newsman. Some of his spot news reporting and very, very distinguished. His reporting of the assassination of President Kennedy was certainly, even though it was a tragedy, one of the great moments in broadcast journalism. He was an excellent reporter on the space program, which had his enthusiasm. Sadly, the legacy was hurt somewhat by, at least in my mind, and I think the minds of many people with my point of view, with his reporting from Vietnam. When he went to Vietnam and he basically delivered what was an editorial on his opinion about what should be done there, it does not stand up over time. It was not well researched. We were not doing badly at that time. In fact, we were actually doing quite well, and he did not inform the public correctly. And his analysis of what we should do was actually not very good. And I think that has to be held against him, not simply because it was a bad moment, because all journalists have bad moments, but the fact that he never sought afterward to modify and say, look, you know, I may not have been completely right. To the end of his life, he defended what he did. I thought that defense was a bit hollow.
Yeah.
He was a man of the left, that later came out, and I think that did start to influence the way he was conducting himself as a journalist.
Now, Bill, when he left CBS, he died at 92, so he left he was a man in the mid-60s when he left the CBS Evening News, I guess. But did he want to leave, or because I've heard both things. I've heard that he wanted to retire, and then I've also heard that they sort of politely told him to retire. What do you know about it?
Well, there were several instances in Walter Cronkite's career when CBS wanted to ease him out. Earlier in his career, they for whatever reason wanted to get rid of him. I don't know why, but when the time came for him to retire, he reached the mandatory retirement age of 65, and they didn't ask him to stay on. There were stories at the time that they felt it was time for a new generation to take over. There were two contenders for his job, Roger Mudd and Dan Rather. My own feeling is they chose the wrong person. Rather, they should have chosen Mudd. But he himself has said that after he left CBS, there was really very little contact between him and the network. And after a few years, essentially no contact. They did not really ask him to come back to do the kind of commenting and visiting professor kind of thing that he expected. I think they felt it was time just to move on.
I got to ask you a quick question, though. You remember the 1952 convention,
yes,
or the televising of that convention. What was the coverage like? Was it 2 or 3 hours a night, or was it just?
If I remember correctly, I'm doing this from memory, so I may not remember every detail. It was pretty continuous. I mean, this was considered really a great moment in television history because people could see a national convention. Now, if I recall correctly, there was some television coverage of the 1948 conventions. But what you had between 1948 and 1952 was the explosive growth in the sale of television sets. I mean, even with 1948 coverage, very few people had TV. But by 1952, television was growing substantially just in terms of its coverage of the country, and covering a national convention was considered a major news event. I'd also point out that in 1952, the results of the convention were sometimes in doubt. I mean, there were real fights at the 1952 Republican convention between the Taft forces, forces of Robert Taft, senator from Ohio, sometimes known as Mr. Republican, and the forces of Dwight Eisenhower, who had never been active in politics and who declared himself a Republican and allowed himself, in effect, to be drafted by the Republican Party. There were resentments over this. There was friction. There was an attempt by some to promote the candidacy of Douglas MacArthur, who wound up getting only one delegate vote. But it was very exciting. I mean, I can, you know, this goes back more than half a century, and I can't recall every detail, but I recall, even as a young person, being glued to the set.
Yeah, that must have been very interesting back then, because how many reporters do you think they had working on the floor? Like five, or was it all just Cronkite, or did they have reporters on the floor?
I don't remember.
Yeah, because I know in later years, you know, what I recall, you know, 76 and 1980 and so on, when these conventions, when I recall watching them, clearly there were lots of reporters on the floor, and Cronkite would sort of oversee all of them. But anyway, let's move on to Apollo 11. I am so lucky to have been alive that day, and I remember, yeah, sitting around, speaking of Walter Cronkite, sitting around with my mom, my dad, my younger brother and sister in the living room, and last night on the History Channel they reran a lot of that, and I was so proud of the country. I was so proud of civilization that day, and it seems to me that that is one day, Bill, that people will be talking about 100 years from now, 200 years from now. You know, when they think of the 20th century, I would have to think that Apollo 11 is one of the greatest days in world history. How do you view it?
I view it exactly the same way. It was the first time in all of human history that mankind reached a heavenly body, a body in space. And yes, it has to be one of the most important days of human history and of exploration. And I remember it very distinctly. We had a 2-month-old daughter, and we put her in her little baby seat in front of the television set so that we could tell her someday that she watched Apollo 11 also. Of course, she doesn't remember it, having been 2 months old, but it was a spectacular event. People today, young people today, don't realize that the space program was embedded in people's consciousness in the 1960s. If you went to Grand Central Station in New York during a space flight, there was a huge screen, and they would carry the space flight live, and people would just freeze in Grand Central Station and watch it. And most people were watching it still on black and white television sets. Color was very much in, but most people still had black and white TVs. And I remember when Armstrong landed on the moon, and it was just that incredible moment, especially for people in my generation who were brought up on science fiction movies like Destination Moon, and they were considered to be pure fiction. Now, we will never get to the moon, or maybe, you know, in 100 years. And there it was in 1969, man going to the moon. And we did it with essentially what would be considered today rudimentary equipment. An iPhone that people use has thousands of times more computing power than the computers used to send Apollo 11 to the moon.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Because what I remember watching it with my mom and dad, my father is 83 years old, so he grew up reading all these comics. And my father kept saying, you know, to my mom and all of us sort of talking as we were watching this, my father kept saying, I cannot believe this. I cannot believe it. I mean, there was almost a sense. I mean, it wasn't that they thought it was fake. That's not what I mean. But it was just a sense of, wow, I mean, man walking on the moon. And, in fact, I may be wrong, but I think it was Walter Cronkite, or maybe one of the other people on the set. But I think it was Walter Cronkite who said at one point, my gosh, man has been on the moon 5 minutes. This is 5 minutes after Apollo 11 landed. And I remember the countdown, Bill, you know, going down to the moon and, you know, coming down, and then those great words from Neil Armstrong, you know, Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed, I think,
right.
Something like that. I mean, just
yes.
It just shakes you up to even think about it. But a lot of young people today, you know, I have three sons. I've been telling them to watch this stuff on TV. Adriana, you have a couple of sons a little younger. I think they're both in their teens. What are they saying about the Apollo 11?
Well, they have watched some of their videos, and they think it's interesting. I don't think that they get as excited, as you say, as your father was, or as other people back then got, because our kids grew up with us telling them these stories, watching videos, seeing technology at a high degree. So I think that these type of events, it's more difficult for them to understand how important were for people from older generations. But certainly they recognize they have been the NASA base in Houston, and they have done the whole tour where they have been able to see how it has progressed, and they find that quite interesting and amazing.
Yeah. Bill, the amazing thing about the program, and maybe you can talk about this a little bit, but the amazing thing about Apollo 11 is that this was part of a 10-year-old program? I mean, back in Sputnik, when the Soviets went to space first with Sputnik, we reacted and we began to focus on the moon program. So Apollo 11 was sort of the culmination of many, many years of hard work and often very bad accidents and so on. Talk a little bit about that and what it meant to so many people to have Apollo 11 succeed.
Well, it was the culmination of a promise that President Kennedy made. President Kennedy, when he took office, said that it was his goal to place a man on the moon and bring him back safely by the time the decade was out. And we just made it. July, you know, the decade would end in about 5 months from the time Apollo 11 went up. But it was also the culmination of a race with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union beat us into space, and people do not realize today what a stunning moment that was in, I believe, 1957, when Sputnik went up and started broadcasting those signals, and we realized that we called it Russia. It was the Soviet Union, but most people called it Russia, that Russia had beaten us into space. And it was a humiliating moment for the United States. There was a lot of self-reflection. We talked about the importance of producing more and better scientists. In fact, the word scientist suddenly became very prestigious because of what was happening. And our first few attempts to simply equal the Soviet accomplishment failed. People watched on live television as rockets, I believe they were called Redstone rockets, burst into flames on the launching pad. And it was only when the, I think, I'm doing this from memory, I believe our first space capsule was called Pioneer, I believe, and that was sent up. That did succeed, but then the Soviet Union kept beating us. They had the first man in space. When Alan Shepard went into space, he was not the first man. He was the first American in space. And there was this sense that we were behind. By the end of the decade, though, when we put a man on the moon and the Russians weren't even close, I think it was a moment of great satisfaction that the United – kind of like a Hollywood movie. We came from behind and won. And that, it was that kind of a moment.
Yeah. And what about the political consequences of Sputnik? When Sputnik went up and sort of caught us off guard, was there much of a political backlash? I guess it was Eisenhower at the time or whoever for not being ready or not knowing what the Soviets were doing?
I think the political backlash actually was delayed until the 1960 election. When Sputnik went up, there was a sense of great frustration, but nobody blamed Eisenhower. Eisenhower was a kind of a father figure and very highly respected, been a five-star general. Nobody questioned his defense expertise. But 3 years later, when President Kennedy ran for office, he claimed that the Soviet Union was ahead of the United States in missile technology. It was called the missile gap, very famous term of the period, and that we were behind, that we had to catch up. Now, it later turned out there was no missile gap, that we were actually, by that time, quite current in missile technology. But the use of the term by Kennedy during the campaign was quite effective. And what's interesting to note is that in 1960, Kennedy, a Democrat, actually ran to the right of his opponent, Richard Nixon, on national defense. And the missile gap argument was part of that. Today, the Democratic Party at times doesn't even show much interest in national defense. But then it was a very hawkish party.
Yeah. Do you think, Bill, one last question about the space program. Do you think that we as a country right now have the, if I can use the word stomach or whatever, to go back into space? I mean, it's amazing. I was telling, my son was asking me, when was the last time that we were on the moon? And as I recall, it was 1972. So it's been 36 years. There's talk now about going back or not going back to the moon, but going to Mars. Do you see that happening at all? Do you think there's much interest in the country or the political will? I guess the money has a lot to do with it, too.
Well, now the money, I think, is become a major factor in it. You know, it's very hard to read that, Silvio. I'm very discouraged by the lack of imagination of some young people, and I think it's a reflection of what they're being taught in school. The schools do not teach the notion of heroism and exploration and daring the way they used to. 25% of young Americans believe the moonshot was a hoax. That's just a staggering figure. These are young people. These are people who weren't even alive when it occurred. And you wonder, where are they getting this from? What kind of junk is this? But do we have the stomach for it? I think enough Americans do that with the proper presidential leadership, we could have a very exciting space program in the future. Sad to say, I don't see that leadership. I really don't.
I'm sorry, go ahead and finish.
Go ahead, no, go please.
No, what I was going to say, Bill, that one of the consequences of going to the moon was all of the technological things that happened, you know,
absolutely,
computers. So there could be some wonderful things that we can get out of going to, you know, continuing the space race and maybe going to Mars or whatever. But, you know, I think you're right. I think it's probably going to happen, but not anytime soon. Certainly not with these trillion-dollar deficits that we have.
I'm afraid that's right. And oh, by the way, while we were talking, I went to my bookshelf and pulled down a book on music history, history of songs. You mentioned at the beginning, since we're speaking of the moon, the song Magic is the Moonlight. Correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
It was written in 1930, and the music was by someone named Maria Grever. That's the person. It was used in a film called Bathing Beauty, and then in 1950 it was used in the film Nancy Goes to Rio, and it was sung by Jane Powell, and later it was reprised by Ann Southern. So you were right. Magic is the Moonlight.
Magic is the Moonlight. That's a song that my parents used to love in Spanish.
Yes.
Called Te Quiero Dijiste. In fact, one of the greatest versions of that song, Bill, was by Nat King Cole, who recorded an album in Spanish. He recorded an album in Spanish in Cuba in the late 50s, and it was one of my parents, it still is one of my parents' favorite albums, and he has a version of that song in Spanish. Magic is the Moonlight. It's one of the most beautiful songs about the moon. Bill, thank you very much. As always, it's a real pleasure to have you, and when we do these historical events, you're always the first one we think of.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be discussing these things and to be with you again, Silvio, and you, Adriana.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay.
I really appreciate all your comments. I learned a lot from you.
Oh, thank you.
Keep writing those wonderful posts, Bill.
I will. And we'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much. That was Bill Katz of Urgent Agenda, one of our favorite blogs. And it's a lot of fun to talk to Bill, Adriana.
Right, yeah.
He's so interesting, so knowledgeable, and he sort of puts a lot of these things in perspective. We will be right back with Alberto de la Cruz, who's calling in from Florida. We're going to be talking with him about Honduras. And speaking of the moon, Adriana, I've got another one here, another quick song called July Moon. Now, this is a bit of an instrumental one, though. That's a beautiful song by a fellow named Brian McRae, Adriana, and it happens to be called July Moon, which is, of course, a pretty important date when we talk about the moon. Let's say hello to our friend Alberto de la Cruz. How are you, Alberto?
Good. How are you, Silvio?
Just doing great. Adriana.
Hi, Alberto.
Hi, Adriana. How are you?
How are you?
Just great, Alberto. Listen, it's a real treat to have you on the show and to join us here on our roundtable. Just before you, we were talking to Bill Katz of Urgent Agenda, one of our favorite bloggers. And, of course, Babalu is also one of our very favorite bloggers. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Alberto, before we get into the heavy stuff?
Well, you know, first of all, I want to thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be on the show with you. And, basically, I'm a Cuban-American. As the T-shirt says, I'm a American made with Cuban parts. I was born here in the United States. But my parents emigrated here a couple years before I was born. And basically, it wasn't until I was around 7 or 8 years old that I realized that I wasn't born in Cuba. That's how Cuban I was raised.
Were you raised in Miami?
Yeah, Little Havana, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
So once I kind of figured out I wasn't born in Cuba, I was kind of upset. But nonetheless, it runs through my veins, and I can't ignore it.
No. And what? How did you get involved with the Babalu blog?
Well, actually, I started writing a few years ago. You know, mostly just to. It was actually right after the Elyon fiasco and horrible thing that happened back then, and I started writing out of frustration, and I ended up starting up a little website where I was just featuring some of my writings. It was more for my own personal, just to let out, just to express myself. And being in Miami, I met Val Prieto from Babalu, and we became friends. And then one day he asked me to start writing with, become a contributing writer on Babalu, and I just from then I just started writing and writing. It was it's a great forum. There's a great bunch of guys at Babalu, and I feel very fortunate, and I'm very happy to be a part of that group.
We've had Henry on the show, Henry Luis Gomez. We've had him on the show before, and through the Babalu blog, we've gotten to know others like Roberto Campiononi and John O'Donnell, Rosales,
right,
and others that we've gotten to know through that. But let me kind of give you an idea of what we do. We have a little roundtable at the end of every show, and we sort of bring in a guest like you, and then Adriana and I go back and forth on a few topics. But what caught our attention about you was the article that you wrote about Honduras and what's happening down there, and that connection between Honduras and Venezuela, that connection that seems to be more and more frightening. I guess you found an article in a Spanish newspaper, right? Is that how it started?
Well, it all started on Friday night, and I come across an article from a Spanish newspaper, and I had gotten an email from one of our regular readers, and I happened to have been at dinner, sitting at dinner, and doing what my wife hates, checking my emails on my phone. And it popped up again, and I said, let me take when I got home, I took a closer look at it, and I read the article, and I kind of searched the English media for the article, and I didn't find anything. So I said, I'm going to wait probably till tomorrow, wait for the English-speaking media to catch up. And since I mainly write in English, I go, I'll use the English media to back it up. I get up Saturday morning, and there's still nothing. So I decided to just translate the article. That wasn't Spanish, from a Spanish newspaper. I also found the original article in La Tribuna in Tegucigalpa. And I posted on it, and I said, any minute now, the AP is going to pick it up, Reuters is going to pick it up. This is a huge story. They found 45 computers preloaded with the election results of the referendum that never took place. And, this is a huge...
That's a major thing, yeah.
That's a major, major development. And, in the Tribuna article, you see the pictures. They show the computers. The computers were owned by the Ministry of Science and Technology. So, what were they doing in a building next to the 45 computers in the building next to the presidential palace? Just a lot of fishy things. So I waited. I wrote the article. And by Saturday afternoon... a few, big blogs like, Hot Air and American Thinker and conservative blogs started picking it up, and then it just became a firestorm. And I said, okay, by Sunday for certain, there's going to be, somebody's got to talk about it. Sunday came and went, absolutely nothing. And more big blogs started picking it up, but no news services, not a one. More Spanish news services picked it up. It was reported throughout Spain and Argentina. And even Nicaragua had an article about it, and still nothing. And I just happened to have checked about 30 minutes ago before I tuned into your show, and there still isn't any news of it whatsoever in English. I mean, I've used every search term, short of reading every single article that has Honduras in it. I've used, different search query strings to, Honduras seized, Honduras seized, Honduras, Honduras computer, nothing. You put Honduras computadora, and you get all the Spanish articles.
I think, Alberto, the only, other than bloggers like Rick Moran, I know he picked it up, Ed Morrissey of Hot Air, he picked it up because I saw it first at Babalu, but then I saw the other references, Rick Moran, American Thinker. You're right, but I think Bill Katz of Urgent Agenda picked it up too. But
yeah, I believe. Well, I mean, right now, if you look at the pingbacks, it's 30 some odd different websites linking back to it. And, you know, a couple of times I saw one, you know, like the UK Independent. Like, oh, wow, you know, they finally picked it up. And when I checked the link, someone put it in the comments.
Yeah.
Someone left a comment on another article I had, you know, that was, I'm not even going to get into it. It was a ridiculous editorial piece saying how wonderful Zelaya is and, you know, everybody. So.
But one person, though, you may be familiar with this one, Alberto. One person who has been following two people that I know of. One we had on the show, Fausta Wirtz. We had her on the show a few weeks ago. And then the other person is called Mary Anastasia O'Grady of the Wall Street Journal. She's been writing extensively and writing some very good stuff about it. And just a few days ago she wrote, I'm not sure if she quoted your article specifically, but she did talk about the Venezuelan influence. And that's really what concerns most of us. I mean, you know, whether they change presidents or not, that's kind of a domestic matter. But I think what really bothers me is the influence of Chavez throughout Latin America, the way he's going around trying to create these little problems for countries that just cannot defend. I mean, a small country like Honduras, well, they don't have the money to compete with somebody like Chavez. I mean, he could come in there and spend millions of dollars and create a real domestic problem for their country. I mean, that's my concern. And let me ask you a quick question, Alberto. Why do you think that the Obama administration has been so, I don't know what the right word is, but has been so wrong, I guess wrong is the right word, has been so wrong on this? I mean, this is, to me, this is so obvious. You got Chavez involved. Why do you think Obama has missed the story?
Well, I have a theory on that, but before I get into that, I just wanted to mention, I don't know if you've heard this, but at 2:45 this afternoon, the one of the Honduran ministers came out and announced that all Venezuelan diplomats are to leave the country within 72 hours, and they're calling back all their diplomats from their Honduran embassy in Caracas.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well,
so,
that's
something that's just that came up this afternoon. It's a huge piece of news, which the media picked up right away. It came out first in Spanish, obviously, in the Honduran newspapers, and of course, the mainstream media has picked up that article. But nevertheless, that's a huge twist of the plot as we keep going. And basically, the minister said they were sick and tired of Venezuela meddling in their internal affairs and making, you know, threats. And I applaud Honduras for doing it. Now, as far as Obama, I think my theory on this, and you know, and you can pretty much, if you apply this theory, it kind of fits into a lot of the things he does. He's a very convenient person, and for him right now, it's more convenient for him to deal with a Zelaya than it is to deal with, you know, a Micheletti, an interim government in Honduras. For the same reason, you know, for the reason that he didn't. You know, he's insisting on ignoring the Honduran Constitution and making believe and continuing to echo the same words that Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro are echoing, calling it a military coup and or a coup d'etat and a military takeover, which it was not. They were following. But what were they going to do, send the Supreme Court justices to the palace to go, you know, arrest him? Of course they send the military. Who else are they going to send? But he doesn't want to have to deal with that. And the same reason he did it there is the same thing he did with Iran. He didn't want to have to deal with a government in shambles and, you know, revolution going on. The devil you know is to him is more comfortable than, you know, the one he doesn't know. And in the end, Obama is about his legacy, and he's about, you know, getting his agenda forward, and he really doesn't care about the Honduran people. I believe he doesn't really care about the Iranian people. He cares about doing, you know, moving forth with his plan. And I think that's why he's, he's reacted this way because it really doesn't make. I mean, that Ramirez cartoon. I don't know if you guys saw it with.
Yeah, I saw that with the three birds.
With the three parrots sitting
there,
you know.
Yeah. In fact, I put that on my blog. That's great. That's great.
It's amazing to me because you're really dealing with a person that has no, you know, has no moral compass. It's just basically I have an agenda and I will do whatever is necessary to get it through. And I personally, that's, you know, that's my theory on him, on a, you know, my personal psychoanalysis of our president. And I think that's, you know, that's what drives him. And he really, you know, whether or not Zelaya was violating the Constitution is of little concern to him.
Yeah.
It's more convenient with him to deal with some, you know, keep it quiet and don't rock the boat.
Yeah. Well, Alberto, we're going to thank you very much for having joined us. What I'd like to do on another time is have you back and talk more about not just Honduras, but Latin America in general and some of the stuff that you've been doing. But I want to thank you very much for joining us and keep writing all those great articles.
Well, I appreciate that. It was a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate you guys having me on.
Thank you very much, Alberto. Keep up the good work, and Adriana and I will be back to finish the roundtable right after this. Adriana, that was a very interesting guest, Alberto de la Cruz from Miami. I liked what he said, you know, that he's Cuban made of American, or what did he say, American made of Cuban parts. I thought that was a great way to describe someone born in the United States. You know, there's a lot of people like him, and what I love about it is that they've grown up in the United States, but they still have a great love and conviction for the cause of Cuban freedom, and that's something that I always love to hear, you know.
Well, yeah, I was reading a little bit about his blog, and even Michelle Malkin made comments about the blog where he writes, and they are mainly people who are, just like you described, of Cuban background, who really are fighting for a Cuba Libre, for a free Cuba.
That's right, that's right. And we had, you may remember Henry Luis Gomez. We had him, we jokingly call him El Conductor, and we had him on the show several months ago. You may not remember, but we had him on to talk about Cuba. But let's talk a little bit about a couple of issues, and then let's get some updates on upcoming shows. Let me just tell the listeners that tomorrow night I'm going to be doing my Cuban show, which is all going to be about baseball, Adriana, so I don't expect you to tune in. But this it's going to be a great Cuban show. We're going to have several Cuban Americans on, and we're even going to have some friends from Mexico who are going to be joining us to talk about the history of some Cuban players in Mexico. It's going to be a lot of fun, and that's going to be on tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Central Time, and we're doing it late because that's the only time I can get all of these people from different time zones to work with us. And then on Thursday, we're also going to be on at 9 o'clock Central Time. And Adriana, why don't you tell us about that show?
Yeah, on Thursday, we're going to have Mr. Richard Rios. He's the chairman of the Republican National Hispanic Assembly in California. And he's also a candidate for national chair of the Republican National Hispanic Assembly. The elections of that position will be done during the National Convention of the Republican National Hispanic Assembly in Washington. And I am planning to go as president of Voces, and I'm going with Edna Cuellar McDaniel and the Mayor Diane Costa, both of them board members of the boards of directors of Voces. But Mr. Rios is going to be our special guest on Thursday, so he's going to speak about his plans for the RNHA in the national level. He's an outstanding Latino who wants to do the same thing that Silvio and I have been talking for a long time, to bring more Latinos to the party, to educate the people with the conservative issues. So it will be a very interesting interview.
Great. Now tell us a little bit. I got a couple of things here to talk about. Tell us a little bit about a speech that you gave a few days ago here in town.
Well, I do know that you were not there. Actually, this is the same speech that I have been giving since November, so it's not like it's a new speech. Certainly, every time that I speak, I am speaking at a different audience. I am speaking mainly at different Republican clubs, not only in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but in all Texas, and I hope to be traveling to Nevada, to California, and other places, but it's called the Republicans and the Latino Vote, and I mainly speak to people who are not Latino so they can meet the Latino leaders that they are raising in the country, those not only the Republicans but also the Democrats. And I also speak with the Republicans with some suggestions I give at the end regarding how do I think we can do a better job in reaching the Latinos for the conservative cause. And I got a wonderful reception at the Louisville Hospital at the Denton County Executive Committee meeting last week, and I felt really very blessed with the feedback that I got after the speech. And I will give the speech again tomorrow at Tarrant County, Young Republicans of Tarrant County, and on Monday in the Executive Committee meeting of Kaufman County. So those of you who were unable to go to one meeting, they can go to another one close. Like you, Sylvia, you could go in August the 4th. I'm going to be in Louisville at the Republican Assembly, so I will send all that information and keep you updated. Thank you.
Great, great. Let's just briefly talk here as our minutes are winding down. By the way, we do have our chat room open, and there is a guest who was listening to the show. He doesn't want to say anything. He just thinks it's a good show. But anyway, so let's we appreciate the fact that he's chatting with us that way. We are working on expanding our chat room, and hopefully in a few months or in a few weeks, it can be very big, and many of you can participate. One last thought here, Adriana, before we round it up, and that is there appears to be a very cynical move, and I say cynical because they're not coming out saying it, but there appears to be a very cynical move here to put abortion into this health care proposal. And, you know, I understand that abortion is legal in the United States. I understand that because of Roe v. Wade. We know that abortion is legal. But the idea that somehow health care, particularly government health care, would be paying for abortions, I do think that's a bit of a stretch. And that's not, I don't believe that's what a lot of taxpayers believe, that their tax dollars should go to finance abortion. So I was wondering, you know, besides the moral issue, I understand how you feel about abortion. I share your moral issue on that. But I'm just talking in terms of your tax dollars. I don't like my tax dollars going to finance abortions.
That is true. As you said, we both, on the moral side, we know that abortion is wrong. That is absolutely difficult for us to understand. And those people on the hard left, they want the access to abortion in demand. But also talking about from the view of a taxpayer, how is possible those liberal Democrats who want to pursue the Freedom of Choice Act that we have been talking about, what they want to do is that they want to accomplish that a healthcare reform bill provide a public plan, and in other words, that our taxes will be paying for the abortions to say for murdering these babies inside the mother's wombs. And I think this is absolutely unthinkable. And the universal care means universal coverage, and certainly the pro-abortion liberal Democrats believe that abortions are an integral part of the women's health, and we all know that that is not true. And certainly we need to fight against that. We need to fight against this.
Yeah, well, they have a word for it, which it's almost laughable. If it weren't, I mean, it's laughable, but it's not laughable because we are, after all, talking about the unborn. But they have a word for it called reproductive rights. And I'm sitting there saying, you know, who came up with that one? Reproductive rights. Whose reproductive rights are we talking about? I guess they mean the woman who's getting the abortion. It's not the reproductive rights of the father, because many times fathers, you know, have no say, or they have no idea on the woman getting an abortion. It's certainly not the reproductive rights of the little girl who may be getting aborted. So it just seems to me that it's a very funny and cynical way of them to get around that word abortion. So they put it in the context of rights, you know, reproductive rights. And I just think that's, as I said, it would be laughable, but it's not laughable because we're talking about the life of the unborn. And, you know, but there's another problem here too, Adriana, and that is that we are talking about tax dollars. I mean, you know,
yeah.
We don't agree with Roe v. Wade. It is the law of the land, so you can get an abortion if you want to. But to have taxpayers, in a sense, all of us paying for abortion, I find that to be very, very troubling. And I'm beginning to wonder whether this health care is going to pass anyway. But if it does pass, I think it cannot include any kind of government paid for abortions. I think Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things you were telling me before, and certainly we cannot understand, is people like Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, who advertise themselves as Roman Catholics. It's very difficult for us to understand how these people are promoting the pro-abortion health care bill, because it's what is it, and providing taxpayer-funded abortions. And not only that, I would like to suggest to all our listeners to watch other programs, and you and I have been watching in Fox News and in other programs when they bring in the programs either Sean Hannity or Mike Huckabee. They can bring doctors, medical doctors from Canada, people from Canada who come and share with the audience what is to have a universal health care and what a mess it is and what a difficult situation we will get into. And people are being deceived. And they're not getting this information, Sylvia. We need to tell the people that it would be a very, very wrong decision to go to this type of universal health care bill.
No, yeah. In fact, Mike Huckabee on Saturday night, was it Saturday night or Sunday night?
Both days. They repeat
both
the program
times, yeah.
Twice a day.
He had a Canadian, that's right, he had a Canadian doctor and a lady from Canada as well. And, you know, we're not trying to, you know, criticize Canadians. I mean, as I said, Canadians are good neighbors, and they're also one of the few countries actually fighting in Afghanistan, so we appreciate that. But yeah, there are problems with the Canadian program, which is the reason that many Canadians come over here. And I think you're right. I think we need to learn more about the shortcomings of this universal care, because I have a funny feeling that it's not going to be that universal if we actually get it. Well, Adriana, that's going to wrap it up for today.
Mm-hmm.
We will be back on the air with you in about 48 hours with our show with Richard Rios, talking about the history of the Republican Party. And I will be back tomorrow night doing our Growing Up Cuban program. So I want to thank you again, Adriana, for joining us as always, and our thanks to Alberto de la Cruz, and of course our thanks to Bill Katz for that amazing contribution. Isn't he great? Every time Bill Katz comes, I just learn so much. I just love listening to him, as I'm sure you do also, Adriana.
Yes, I do. I learn a lot from Bill Katz.
Yeah, we really learn a lot from him. He writes one of the best blogs in the country called Urgent Agenda, and I check it every day, and I certainly recommend that you check it every day. It's very, very well written and very, very topical. I mean, if it's happening, Bill is writing about it. Well, that's going to wrap it up, folks. Have a great day, and we'll talk tomorrow, and we'll talk to you on Thursday, Adriana. We'll talk to everybody a little bit later. Everybody have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you.